Welcome to the Herpetile Podcast. My name is Nash and I love herpetology. This podcast explores all things to do with reptiles and amphibians. I hope you like it. Welcome to my show. My name is Nash and I'm the host of the Herpetile Podcast. My guest today is Scott Iper. Scott is an author of four books. The most recent is called Snakes of Australia, which Scott wrote with his wife. Scott is also a herpetological consultant, author, and wildlife photographer, and also conducts wildlife surveys, emergency removals, and educational displays. He also writes articles in Australian Herpetiforma. Welcome to my show, Scott. How are you?
How are you, Nash?
Good. How are you? So my first question for today is, how and when did you first become interested in working with animals?
Okay. My first encounter that I can remember with a reptile, I was absolutely mesmerized by it. I was 3 years old and very, very young.
Yeah.
And so it's actually my earliest memory. And it was a red-bellied black snake that had got too close to my grandparents and they ended up shooting it.
Oh.
And so it's not quite sad, but it's understandable. Things have changed over the years.
Yeah.
Anyway, so as this kid, I got taken up to this red-bellied black snake and I was told not to go anywhere near it and never to touch one.
Yeah.
So that worked not very well. And as a result, I started running around the bush catching little skinks and little geckos and stuff like that from the age of about four.
Yeah.
I'm almost 40 years old now and nothing much has changed. I still run around the bush catching lizards and geckos and snakes.
So you like to go herping?
Love to go herping. Bit hard at the moment with this
coronavirus,
with the COVID-19 stuff and being socially responsible and staying indoors and only going out if you have to.
3 years very early to see your first reptile. I think for me it was only like 2 years ago when I was walking on a bit of a big hill, or you could say a mountain. It was a rocky one, and my sister was running really fast on the track, and there was a big tiger snake, and we thought it was a stick, and she just ran right next to it.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough. The tiger snakes, we do like tiger snakes. We have a couple of pet tiger snakes here.
What did you have to study? Because you do quite a lot. So did you have to study many things?
Well, it would have been more advantageous for me to do more study than I have. I actually ended up leaving school a little bit early. And that made it difficult to work in the herpetological.
You need to get pretty high grades.
And so I never went. Oh, my grades were good. I just decided that I didn't want to be at school anymore, so I ended up leaving. And I ended up, I've got a trade, so I'm a plumber, gas fitter by trade. And then on top of that, I started doing lots of volunteer work. So I was always keeping reptiles and amphibians as pets, and then I got into doing demonstrations. I started doing demonstrations when I was 12 years old at scout groups and stuff like that. And then was assisting at places like the Royal Melbourne Show and
so when you were younger, shows. You were like and then, getting more reputable? Like you were getting more reputation as like,
Yeah, I was starting to develop a reputation when I was very young. I was one of the youngest people. I grew up in Victoria. I was the youngest person to hold their venomous snake license in Victoria. So I had a license to keep venomous snakes.
What did you
when
see?
I was 12 years old.
What was that animal?
I had tiger snakes and I had copperheads and death adders all that sort of stuff. I started keeping snakes at 10 years of age. And by the time I was 14, I had everywhere, everything, anything from taipans through to tiger snakes and death adders and stuff like that. I had my first snake bite at 14. Was it from a western brown snake? I went to hospital. I survived. I was okay. I've had a couple of serious bites over the years, but yeah. So I started catching snakes when I was very young, and then ended up getting a license and was buying and selling animals and ended up getting venomous snakes when I was young too.
It says that you conduct wildlife surveys. What do you do when you do that?
Yes. So it depends on what the survey is required, what I'm doing. So it might be I'm looking at the amount of animals that are in a particular population area. Okay, so yeah, it could be looking at population density or just species profiles and seeing what species are actually in an area. So not necessarily population density, but it could be looking at the whole ecosystem and seeing what's in that ecosystem. So the reptile component makes
so
up
part of that. So you were trying to like get more on record of what's where? Yeah.
What actually lives in said location? So, I've done some targeted wildlife surveys. So that's where you're looking for a particular species. And what you would do is while you were there, you would also record any other species of note while you were there as well. So, we might be going and doing a survey for a Karumba tinker frog. And on the way down to the site where you find that Karumatika frog, you might see a death adder or something like that. And you GPS where you found it. You take measurements of the temperature.
I can't hear you right now.
Hear the time of day, the condition of the animal. You might take a photo.
Yeah, you just like broke up for a second.
You're right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay. Sorry. So you might take a photo of the animal and you take down various bits of information. We have a specimen data sheet, which gives you a whole heap of different things that you would write down. And then you would submit that at the end as part of your report.
On another podcast that the rate of actually finding a snake when you're looking for it is very low. How do you, like, counteract that when you're looking for them in surveys?
Experience and time. So what you'll see is you'll see a reference to things like trap nights or survey hours. And so that's a way that you can try and quantitate the effort or the time or the effort searched or the time searched. And so you would equate it that way. Because these things are very difficult to find, the rate of effort for finding is often quite substantial. So there's a lot of effort.
You work with a lot of venomous snakes. How many times would you have been bitten?
I have been seriously envenomated twice. Okay. And I've had a number of dry bites. So a dry bite is a bite that could have resulted in a serious envenomation, but the venom injected was not sufficient to make me seriously ill.
Do you think there was the worst one you've ever had?
The scariest bite that I had was from a snake that was actually has actually been classed as medically insignificant, and that's a swamp snake. It was back in 2005.
Were you allergic?
And I went into anaphylactic shock as a result of the venom. So so that's what anaphylactic shock is. What happens when you're allergic to a protein?
When you're looking out for wildlife or herping, are there any species you look for particularly?
Look, I always like to see things that I haven't seen before. And so usually if I'm going out herping in a particular location, there might be something I'm targeting. However, I always like seeing all kinds of reptiles. It doesn't matter if it's a skink or a gecko or a dragon. I do like venomous snakes. I must admit, venomous snakes are probably my favourites. I don't find that I need to go and pick them up. It's not something – a lot of reptiles, when I see them in the wild these days, unless I've got a permit that I need to – that I'm specifically capturing animals for a reason or I'm doing a survey or whatever, that's when I'll handle animals. But generally speaking, if I'm just going out for leisure and just going out and looking at reptiles in the bush, I won't touch them. I'll just watch them. And I thoroughly enjoy watching reptiles in the bush. Not too long ago, I was at a place called Main Range National Park, and we were walking along a creek. And the easiest way to walk through a lot of rainforest is actually to walk along inside the creek. So you just walk along in the shallows of the creek, and you don't get caught up by branches and stuff like that. And there was a rough scale snake, and it was actually actively hunting on the creek. And so I sat there quietly, and I had my camera with me, and I took some photos of it. But I actually watched this rough scale snake for about 15 minutes as it moved along the side of the creek that I was on, and it was sticking its head down into all of the little nooks and crannies between the stones under the water, and it chased out tadpoles. Tadpoles it was eating were things like the tadpoles from great barred frogs and Flay's barred frog, Myxophis flayi and Myxophis fasciolatus. And it was going in there. It would stick its head into the water, into those crevices, find a tadpole, bring its head out of the water, all right, swallow the tadpole out of the water, and then continue to move along. Now, this creek was quite warm because it's a rainforest stream in summer in southeast Queensland, so it's quite warm. But every now and then the snake would come out and sit out onto a stone or like that in the sun and get a little bit of warmth back into its body before going back in.
That there would be different types of looking for snakes or things like that when you're out looking for them? Like if you're actively looking, you're more likely to find an ambush predator, and if you're just sitting there waiting, you're more likely to see an active predator.
Look, there's different types of herping. So you can use, there's basically the two main types are getting out on foot and walking around on foot and actively searching for animals. And that way you'll see animals that are on the move, but you'll also see animals that are sitting in ambush locations. So that could be a leaf-tailed gecko that's sitting upside down on a tree. It could be a death adder that's half curled up in the leaf litter at the base of a rock face. Or it could be a carpet python that's sitting curled up on the base of a vine and it's got its head in an S pattern and it's waiting for a mouse or a melamis or a rat to come past and last thing it ever eats. The other way you can herp is you can jump in a car and go what they call road cruising. Now, road cruising is where you drive down a road. Now, it could be at night or it could be during the day.
Yeah.
And you drive along hoping to see reptiles crossing the road. Now, that doesn't work very well for ambush reptiles because you're not going to see things ambushing things on the road. They're going to be ambushing things in the bush. But you do see lots of animals on the move, and because it's a big, wide, open space, you can cover a lot of ground very quickly, and that's why you get to see lots of animals.
Get into herping much?
Try and find somebody who you can go out with. Don't pick up any snakes. That's always a great tip, particularly in Victoria, because Victoria's got lots of venomous snakes.
Yeah.
Oh, there is six species of harmless snake in Victoria.
Yeah.
Six species and subspecies. So you've got four species of blind snake, which are fantastic animals. You can very interesting. Yeah. And then you've got a couple of species of python. So you've got the inland carpet python, Murillus bellota metcalfe.
Around, yeah.
Yeah, so from, are you in Melbourne, I'm assuming?
Like up north.
You're in the surrounding area of Melbourne? You're north of Melbourne? Well, the nearest point to Melbourne is a place called Pyramid Hill, which is about 2.5 hours from Melbourne, where you can see inland carpet pythons. But getting back to what I was saying is that one of the best places that you can go is actually, there's a place called the Field Naturalist Club of Victoria. At Field Naturalist Club of Victoria, they've got a juniors group. Now, that juniors group has got people that go out under supervision and you go out and you learn not just about reptiles, but you learn about all sorts of things that are out in the bush. And then they go away on trips and stuff like that. They sometimes do trips with the fauna survey group. And that fauna survey group, they do trapping for from various species of animals. Now, that might be bats, it could be birds, it could be reptiles or amphibians. And you'd be going out then with adults.
Then what do you think about the VHS,
they do
Victoria
things ethically, and they know what they're doing.
Society. So, mm-hmm.
I was a member of the Victorian Herpetological Society when I was 9 years old. And I'm no longer a member of the VHS, only because I live in Queensland now. So, but the VHS is a fantastic place. really interesting and very supportive of young people like yourself. I can't go past red-bellied black snakes. Red-bellied black snakes I've always loved since I was a kid. So I also really like coastal taipans. So coastal taipans are very interesting to keep. They're very intelligent as snakes go. And red-bellied black snakes, well, they're such a beautiful animal to keep.
Because you first saw one?
I've kept red-bellied black snakes for the better part of 28 years now. So I've had them a very long time.
Well, you sort of already answered this question.
I really enjoy keeping red-bellies. They're one of my favorites.
So I'll change it to how many different species of snakes do you keep?
Well, I don't keep them by myself. I keep them with my wife, Ty. So my wife, Ty, she actually runs the collection. I'm very busy with my normal work, and so she looks after most of the animals. But I've got a few things that are sort of more mine than hers, I suppose. But we have lots and lots of different species. We've reduced our numbers.
So you've got quite a few.
We've got more than 80 animals here. Okay, so everything from Parentes, which are some of the largest monitors in Australia, to freshwater crocodiles, coastal taipans, inland taipans, tiger snakes, brown snakes, black snakes, death adders, king browns, butlers. Spotted blacks,
so you mostly specialise in venomous snakes, not venomous pythons.
Five different species of death adder. We've got olive pythons, black-headed pythons, womers. We've only just recently got rid of our water pythons. We've got children's pythons, diamond pythons. We have lots of stuff. Pythons, splendid tree frogs or magnificent tree frogs, blue tongues, king skinks, shinglebacks, a couple of different sorts of Cunningham skink. We have some small frogs, turtles.
Do you have any studies that you're working on right now?
Yes. Yeah, I'm working on a couple of things at the moment. There's we're looking at doing some longevity work. So longevity is learning how long something lives for. We're also looking at some reproductive biology stuff as well. So we're looking to breed a couple of more species. We're trying to breed Pilbara death adders.
For the one about how long they live, what understand are you
more of
on?
the reproductive biology of the Pilbara death adder.
Okay.
We're doing that with a number of animals. So we've got an olive python at the moment that is about 38 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So a longevity study is basically how long does that species live for. So for me to tell you how long it's going to live for, I don't know. It could be going for another 5 years or another 10 years.
Extractions, is that often or is that just like a side thing?
I pull snakes out of houses for people on occasion. So what tends to happen is I'm very good at talking myself out of work because I don't like pulling snakes out of houses. The best place for a snake to be is where it is originally. And so what I try to do is I try to convince the other person on the other end of the phone that it's not going to hurt them and the best place for that snake is to stay where it is. But sometimes they're very, very scared or the snake is a venomous snake or the snake is in a place that it can't get away or that the people are freaking out and then I'll go out and remove it. And then I'll try and convince them to be able to let it go on their property. Sometimes it's success, sometimes not. So if they say no, I release it at the nearest patch of bushland that is suitable for that type of snake. So if it's a keelback or a green tree snake,
so you just it would be the don't nearest want them to creek, go too far.
The nearest waterway to where I am at the time. So no, I want to keep them as close to where I found them as possible because snakes get...
Yeah, plus there might be
the further you move a snake, the higher that chance of that animal is of dying.
And then where you moved it to, there's like no population and then it's never going to breed. Yeah. Do you have any tips for people that want to get into venomous snake keeping? Yeah.
Okay. Tips for getting into venomous snake keeping. Be very good to your parents. That's always a good start. In all seriousness, the best thing for you to do if you're interested in getting into venomous snakes is to find somebody who keeps venomous snakes that you know quite well and look to start helping them with cleaning out their enclosures for their non-venomous snakes. But you treat those non-venomous snakes as a venomous snake. So you handle them with the hook. You open the enclosure in such a way as the same way you would open the enclosure for a venomous snake. And you treat a non-venomous snake effectively like a venomous snake and you get used to those manipulation techniques. Once you've done that and you've spent time with another person and spent a lot of time along with another person, try and find someone else who keeps venomous and also work with them because it's always good to learn from a couple of different people. At that time, hopefully you'll be at an age where you can legally keep venomous snakes and then you could look to do maybe a snake handling course. The problem with snake handling courses is that they only give you a little bit of information. You don't get to really learn the whole mechanics of how to read a snake and learn what a snake's going to do.
That and so there's always risk involved. Into owning venomous snakes is to start with local species, because then if you get bit, then it won't be as bad as if you've got something from really far away and there's no,
So in Australia, that doesn't really matter. It is easier to deal with a local species as opposed to something that is
exotic to the area.
Mm-hmm.
That said, in Australia, the probably the best beginner venomous snake is a brown tree snake. Brown tree snake is, they're mildly venomous. Chances are, unless you have an allergic reaction, you're not going to get sick. They're very beautiful and they're very fast moving. And they are very strong, so they can lift themselves up a long way on hooks and stuff like that. So they're a good starting species. Red-bellied black snakes are great. Collet snakes are fantastic, and so are spotted blacks. Death adders make horrible first venomous snakes, so some people recommend death. Working with the death adder really won't teach you how to work with any other venomous snake. The other thing is if you ever need to put your hands on a death adder, particularly as a beginner, that's a very dangerous
What do you think about live feeding? What do you feed them?
So we tried to feed frozen thawed mice wherever possible, or rats or chicken. And then we get some snakes that only like to eat freshly killed or even live. And so what we'll do, if we've got an animal that only likes to eat live, we will do our best to switch that animal onto onto a pre-killed diet. The reason is that some snakes could get especially, bitten and hurt by their prey item.
Right, because they're holding on to it and their body might be right next to its mouth and then it can get a lot of damage.
Yeah, definitely. They've got very sharp, rodents have got very sharp teeth. And also, too, you've got to think about the welfare of both the snake itself, but also the prey animal as well. It feels pain, it can be scared, it can hurt, it can be, so we're not in it to be macabre, we're in it to try and do things painlessly as possible. And so that would mean that we would try and feed in a manner that is as painless as possible for the prey item as well. So I did a course in animal technology which taught me how to euthanize things like rats and mice and other things for experiments. And so I actually know how to euthanize a lot of those sorts of animals in a...
Okay.
Yeah, we breed rats and mice here. And because we breed rats and mice, I go through the motions. There's a couple of ways that you can ethically kill your rodents. One is with carbon dioxide. The other one is with a... cervical dislocation, and we go through and do cervical dislocation on our rodents.
So. Do you do a carbon carbon dioxide?
Carbon dioxide.
Oh
no, we use cervical dislocation.
I have.
Okay. So that's the technical term for breaking its neck. We separate the spine out the base of the brain.
What is an unusual...
Of course.
Two last questions, I'm sorry. What is an unusual... John is, what is an unusual fact about reptiles or amphibians that people might want to know?
Okay. Did you know snakes can hear audible sounds?
Yes, I...
Lots of people say that snakes are deaf,
when people do.
But they're not. Okay, so there was a paper that's just been released about Stoke sea snakes being able to hear anywhere between 600 hertz. So that's quite low sounds, but it is quite a range of sound.
Under their skin.
So they don't have the same middle ear structure like lizards do. But they do have bones that
feed into the back of the lower jaw, and that does enable them to be able to hear.
And my last question for the show is, if you could tell everyone in the world something about reptiles and amphibians or keeping them or anything, what would it be?
If I'm going to tell everyone in the world, what would I tell them about reptiles and amphibians? They're more scared of you than you are of
them. That's a good one. Thank you so much for being on the show, Scott. Thanks for listening to the Herpetile Podcast. Please subscribe so you don't miss out on any of the latest episodes. Happy herping!